Hello and welcome to this episode of Nothing Ventured with me, Arish Shah. Today in the studio with me, I had Igosa Omowigwe. Igosa is managing partner at Echo VC, a seed and early stage technology VC investing in underrepresented founders and underserved markets with a focus on Africa, Europe, and the US. In today's episode, I talked to Igosa about iceberg ventures and what that means, what it means to be serving underserved markets, even if you're not an underrepresented founder, how difficult and challenging it might be for someone of African origin trying to raise a fund in the US in 2014, and what it's going to take to change the pre-seed and seed funding landscape in Africa, in the technology ecosystem out there. This is a great episode, so let's get straight into it. Hello and welcome to this episode of Nothing Ventured with me, Arish Shah. Today in the studio with me, I'm super excited to have Igosa Omowigwe. Igosa is managing partner at Echo VC, a seed and early stage technology VC invested in underrepresented founders and underserved markets with a focus on Africa, Europe, and the US. Prior to setting up Echo, Igosa spent close to a decade at Intel Capital in various roles, but ultimately investing in consumer internet and semantic tech. Igosa splits his time between Lagos, London, and New York. Igosa, welcome to the studio. It's great to have you with me here today.
Thank you very much. I'm glad to be here.
So for our audience, if you want to get a really interesting rundown on Igosa's background and how he set up Echo and his thoughts on kind of where we are in tech at the moment, don't miss the primer. It's out already. It'll been out a couple of days now, so go and check it out. But in the meantime, you know, you invest in underrepresented founders and underserved markets. What does that mean and why is it important? I'm thinking now about kind of more the underserved market side of that, because I think, you know, certainly on this podcast, we've talked a lot about underrepresented founders with many of our guests. But the underserved markets is really interesting. And I think you have a couple of really sort of non-intuitive examples of how that works. So I'd love to hear your thoughts on that.
Sure. So the way we think about underserved markets, people sort of conflate that with emerging markets or frontier markets. And we don't really think about that because frontier markets, there's sort of a formal definition for those and the like. They tend to be sort of, you know, in Africa and, you know, maybe parts of Asia. But for us, underserved markets are comprised of consumers that no one thinks about. Or you know, comprised of, you know, people delivering products and services that no one has attached any importance to creating.
Yeah.
And so, yes, we do have several examples of these where they're not necessarily obvious, but they're the kinds of things that we think very, you know, deeply about. So one of them, of course, is Grow Intelligence, which is an AI platform for food security and climate risk. And you know, food security is a big deal for lots of people. There are actually very significant populations that continue to be food insecure.
Yep.
And a lot of that, you know, really arises from very poor decision making, as well as what I would call a broken, you know, food ledger. Mm-hmm. Right. So where there's a lot more demand in some places and, you know, there's very little adjustment in terms of how you think about food supply and food supply chain. And so that's a very important element for us, right, which is it's an AI platform for food security, and yet, you know, how do you now sort of are able to bring the world into balance, particularly because food is a daily TAM, right? So we did another one, which is also very interesting, which is in stealth. We've never actually sort of formally disclosed it, but it was an entrepreneur that we met who was doing some very interesting work years ago around protein folding. Mm-hmm. And so as part of my research, and I'm no biotech investor. Let's not even make that
Is anyone? You know, let's not even make everyone that mistake, is, but right? Is anyone, yeah. Sure.
But you know, I'm intellectually curious and I try to make as few assumptions as possible. And you know, and I remember when I met him and I was chatting with him and I said, and he asked me, he was like, "Well, you're not a biotech investor, why did you want to talk to me?" I said, well, you know, I've got this interesting idea, and I don't know if it makes any sense, but I just wanted to run it by you. And I said, has anyone ever thought about using protein folding to address sickle cell anemia? Mm-hmm. And he's like, he hadn't, you know. And I said, well, if you think it's viable, we'll invest, right? And he goes away for a few weeks, comes back, and he goes, this is a big market. And I said, yes, I told you that.
Which most people don't think about.
Right?
Yeah.
I said, it's like a billion people, right, that, you know, have either directly or indirectly exposure to sickle cell anemia and its relatives. And so, you know, we did that, right? So it's just another example of a market that sits below the surface,
yeah,
right? So we call them iceberg markets, right? Yeah, so they're always very significant markets, but people undersize them, right? The same thing, we did another one.
Well, I mean, like in that example, though, you know, because again, we talk about underrepresented founders and underserved markets. In that case, the founder was, I mean, objectively not underrepresented, right?
No, like, he's not.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah. So he was not. But he showed enough interest to chase after something that we considered important.
Exactly.
Right. Yeah. And he was positioned for that.
Yeah.
Right. And, you know, when people say, well, you know, if you're looking for underrepresented founders, does that mean it's just only women or black? Not necessarily. Right. Which is also why we pair with underserved markets, because sometimes, you know, a founder that can objectively make a difference to an underrepresented population is not an underrepresented founder.
Mm.
Right. And so we are very big believers in that. We did another one, which we, you know, we never disclosed as well, which was very interesting. So a lot of there's a lot of assumptions around skin cancer and skin diseases,
mm-hmm.
right? And a lot of people feel, for instance, that those who are black or brown, you know, have no risk or exposure to skin cancer.
Yeah, we've got the melatonin, melanin, and we're fine.
We're fine, yeah. Which is not true.
Yeah.
Which is completely not true. And so what you then find as well is that you have a lot of bias in the way you sort of folks think. And so what we did was, as you thought more and more about teledermatology, mm-hmm. right, and using AI for dermatology, you then realized that, and we've seen examples of this in skin tone imagery in you know, on Twitter and the like, that a lot of these automated systems don't know how to recognize dark skin. Right. So, you know, you're sort of thinking about, okay, I don't get this, right? How does this work? And, you know, and so a lot of what we did with this other founder was to think about, you know, dark toned skin, right, for teledermatology. So you're not necessarily, again, people say, well, how is that important? Well, this founder was in a super position for driving AI powered, you know, teledermatology, and just thinking about expanding that to include changes the size of his addressable market, right? And these are examples of underserved markets, right? And we can talk about things like financial services. You know, I always tell people that some of the worst examples of sort of physical poverty I've seen, I've seen in the U.S.,
and the UK now, I would say, as well.
Yeah, you know, like, I mean, you pockets. Go into some parts of the southern US and you would not even understand that you're in a first world country.
Yeah.
Right. And so, you know, bringing that to mind, so when people think, oh, it's just Africa, I'm thinking, no. You know, underserved markets exist in lots of places. Yeah. And so for us, it's always, again, about the open air secret, as I talked about.
Yeah.
We like to invest in founders that are chasing open air secrets.
I mean, for me, it's super interesting because, you know, this whole sort of thought process around underrepresented founders, you know, is one that, as I said, like as a theme on this podcast, we've had lots of people talk about, you know, whether it's investing in female founders, whether it's investing in people from minority ethnic backgrounds. But essentially, if it doesn't matter who you invest in, if they are solving a problem for that market. So I think about, we had recently on the podcast, we had David Fogel, who was one of the first investors in, and then ultimately the COO of WeFarm, right? Which was founded again by essentially a middle-class white dude. But, you know, was serving markets in, you know, East Africa, pairing with farmers in South America, right? If you are creating the ability to change the outcomes for those underserved markets, that I would expect would essentially then lead to, over time, more underrepresented founders having the base from which they can then launch something, right? Because if you start from the premise that a lot of the underrepresented founders don't have the background, the family, the capital base, the network, or whatever to go out and build, if you can actually, you know, and it's abstracting away quite a fair amount, how do you get from a farm in Kenya to someone launching the next M-Pesa or whatever? Right. But presumably there is a causal link there, right? Because you are, if you are able to ameliorate the life of the majority, then a significant minority of that majority will then go out and start building transformational tech, right?
So it's interesting that you bring up WeFarm. We looked at that deal a few times. We passed every time.
Got it.
And, you know, one of the key gating items for us was that we didn't believe that the company had enough of a high resolution understanding of the market they were trying to serve.
Got it. They didn't have the deep understanding of,
I mean, it is an innate understanding, yeah, right? It's sure. not just it's
a lived understanding, I guess, right?
It really is. You know, so you know, when we and the people, you know, founders come and they're telling us things and they really want to know, okay, what is it that you understand? And I'm like, look, you want to go serve farmers in Africa, right? And I say, let me tell you a story, right, about one of our portfolio companies that was providing, you know, distributing subsidies to farmers. Mm. And one of the things they would do would be to do KYC, right? And so they would bring these farmers in to do biometrics. And... you know, for a lot of these farmers that are not mechanized, don't you know, rely on mechanized agricultural inputs and the like, a lot of it's physical, it's hand to hand. And so a bunch of them end up not having fingerprints. And so, you know, story shows up, farmer comes in, doesn't have, you know, enough discernible fingerprints. And they say, we need fingerprints. So he goes back and brings his son and says, okay, use his fingerprints.
Right.
Right. And, you know, and I'm like, so when I'm sitting down in London or in New York and explaining to you how this works, I know you've got some fancy PowerPoint slides and some McKinsey data. And I don't know, I get that. Right. But the high resolution understanding of the market you're trying to serve is critical. And it doesn't necessarily mean that you have to be a member of that demographic, but you have to have, I think, demographic empathy, right, and understanding. And so it's, you know, when we talk about these underserved markets, you know, it's not necessarily that we're necessarily saying these are lived experiences for us, but we're not enough people, and we've been, I think, you know, empathetic enough to truly understand. So don't come in there and just stamp, impose your own view of it. But what does this world look like? And how are the behaviors manifesting themselves? And those are things that, you know, the rational mind are easy, you know, the rational mind can easily dismiss because it just doesn't make sense to you. Why would they do X or Y? That's not the point. The point is that they do X and Y.
Well, and this is, I mean, like the example that I always give is, you know, whilst here in the UK or in the US for that matter, you know, we sit here, we complain about whether our internet online banking works, right? And we're worried about how that website looks and whether the flow works. On the other hand, in Africa, you have people literally sending money via SMS, right? Like, but you would need to understand why, right? That was required at that point in time in that market. And the reason is very simple. You know, people don't have or didn't have smartphones. I think, you know, there's 50% penetration now, but, you know, back in those days, probably 10%, 12%, whatever. But people did have, you know, the Nokias and you know, the SMS technology, right? But yeah, I guess it's that question of how well do you understand that market? And there are some markets, you know, I know, having lived in Papua New Guinea, for example, if you've never lived there, there is no way you will understand like what a cocoa grower in the highlands
goes through,
right? To get their product to market and how that works.
And there's a construct we built internally for investing in these underserved markets, sort of a requirement for how we, you know, the things we push founders to think through. And this one is called, we call it the ZCL, for zero cognitive load. And so it's critical to build products and services that are zero cognitive load, right? And an example of zero cognitive load product is certainly WhatsApp. But the prior example was M-Pesa, right?
Yeah.
And I like to say, you know, what is the most interesting feature of M-Pesa that allows it to be like water? It'll flow anywhere, right? And people are like, oh, because it's mobile. No. Because you don't need to know how to read or write English.
Yeah, yeah.
It doesn't make any assumptions. But even the trader on the side of the road knows how to count 0 to 9.
Yeah.
That is the bottom line, right? Because at the end of the day, they understand the concept of money.
Yep.
Right. So when you're using, you know, not alphanumerals, but just numerals to sort of transmit, receive money, that is a zero cognitive load product. And I tell folks, it's not fancy, but it gets the job done. You know, and when you now start thinking of M-Pesa instead of what was it? It was 60-70% of the Kenya GDP. You're thinking, wow. For a, in quotes, zero cognitive load product, it was doing okay.
Yeah, had no fancy bells, whistles, didn't require it. You know what? The problem now is, of course, I can't get it unless I have a Kenyan mobile number, which was the thing when I was there, like recently, I was like, oh, that kind of sucks.
Yeah, like, well, there's KYC and there's AML and they're all these strictures,
yeah,
right?
Sure.
But it's, you know, the same example, a similar example,
yeah.
You know, is Cash App.
Yep.
Right, in the US, right? Genius product.
Yeah. Or even, you know, WeChat in China.
Zero cognitive load.
Yeah, yeah.
Right. And you know, and what I think people always miss with these you know, underserved markets, you know, is again this iceberg philosophy, just how large they are. Right? They're just, I mean, you look at Block's latest quarter and what Cash App is doing in one quarter, you're thinking, and you know, Cash App is really a middle of America phenomenon.
Yep.
Right. I mean, the coast or whatever it is, you know, there's Snooty, they use Zelle, they this, you know, and all that good stuff. But Cash App is a middle of America phenomenon. And it is a giant of a business. Yep. Right. But again, you know, it's really thinking about these markets. And, you know, you think about it and say, if Cash App woke up today and said, oh, let's go raise money, right? I don't know which VCs will give them money.
Really?
Because it's a market way to be like, eh.
It's not sexy.
No. Like, and like, do these people have any money?
Yeah.
But they do.
Yeah. And in fact, they have money and they're more conscious about how much money they have and where they're spending it, how they're spending it, right? So they are locked in. They don't have the ability to kind of shop around. Right?
So when you're bringing these products to market, what you're also doing is serving markets and customers that have zero to limited optionality.
Yeah.
Right. And that's when you talk about churn, you know, you don't see a lot of churn in these markets because they don't have very much optionality to begin with.
Yeah.
Right. But
these products also become such an embedded part of their life that there's just no way that
they become habits.
Yeah. Habits. Yeah. Absolutely.
Right. And so, So that's how we think about these things.
Yeah, I mean, that's super interesting. I'm sure, again, we could talk about that for another hour as well. But look, when you started raising Echo VC, and we talked again a little bit about this on the primer, but you were a black GP trying to raise money.
I still am, by the way.
You are, yeah. I think I double checked when you came in. You still got the right card. You're carrying the credentials, but you're trying to raise money for a crazy strategy that, like, a random strategy, right? That no one had ever heard of, right? You wanted to invest in these weird places in underserved markets, and you know, people hadn't thought about it or even heard about it, I guess, because we're going back to 2014, right? Like, people weren't thinking about this stuff. But what were the specific challenges you think you faced as a person of color trying to raise a fund, and as a person of African origin, right? Like a Nigerian, of Nigerian origin, trying to raise capital, and how did you overcome them, right? Because I assume, like, especially in the US, again, you are that many parts removed, right? You're not an African-American. You are an African in America, right?
With a weird hybrid accent.
Yeah. So, I don't want to raise that, right. But yeah.
But I think, you know, when I look back now, you know, where did I find sort of coefficient of drag, right? Mm-hmm. Where did I find headwinds? One was the strategy didn't match the allocation structure of LPs. So as an LP kindly told me, you want to do Africa and Asia, LPs don't even set up like that. They might have the rest of the world, Asia, Americas, Europe, right? But they never have any sort of communication between those groups. So that's a problem. The second is that, you know, they don't necessarily see a track record in these markets, right? So yes, you've done some stuff in, you know, in India, and you've done well and all that good stuff, but there's no specific track record in those markets, which I think was a fair pushback on that. And then I think the third was that, you know, I had come close at Intel Capital with big wins, but I was contrarian. And I was right, but I didn't have capital at risk. And that was the biggest loss, right? Because, you know, even when we were fighting for the first Facebook investment and I was begging, you know, I was like, okay, fine, we can't do 260 because the CEO was being weird. The Intel CEO was being weird about it. I still remember walking up and down the corridor trying to beg my boss, okay, can we just do 75, right? And it's kind of interesting because even the 75, right, you know, Facebook got to a trillion. You know, you come in at 75, even at 10 billion, you know, it's a real number, right? But, you know, we never got close enough, right? You know, even LinkedIn, when I wanted to do 85 to 125, you know, that was... You know, we came close again, but didn't get it done.
Yep.
You know, that would have returned, you know, that would have returned 20 plus X.
Yeah.
Right. And so, you know, there were these giant returns. So while I wasn't, you know, I had a few good things out there, the big returns hadn't, I didn't have them. So I could talk about them, but, you know, I could never rely on them. Right. Mm. So I think out there being, you know, people talk about, well, you can, you know, be contrarian, but a lot of the allocated money is really not designed to take those risks, right? And so, you know, I always described the fundraising part as pouring diesel into an F1 engine, and so, you know, and that's why, you know, we kept plugging away. But, you know, what's also interesting is that, you know, even when you're contrarian or right, you know, you look back and people, you know, I still remember people who said, this strategy is dumb. These markets are never going to amount to anything.
Yeah.
Well, the markets actually did amount to something, actually to a lot, right? And so you're
and are continuing to grow.
And continue to grow, yeah. Right? And, but, you know, you don't get prizes for being right, but not getting any money to show you were right, right? And so I think for, you know, back then, and, you know, we're also, you know, sort of black GPs who were capable of writing their own independent checks, right? Not that many.
Yeah.
You know, we're even seeing a whole lot more now, but a bunch of us that went through sort of the, you know, who were sort of, you know, point, you know, on the squad, you took the early incoming fire and a whole bunch of things, you know, it's still difficult for them. Till today, even with all the experience, it's still difficult for them. Meanwhile, you see random people who sort of raise 30, 40, 50, 60 million, and you're thinking, wow, you know. But, you know, the market, there is an opportunity. That means that there's an opportunity to dislocate that market, right? And so, you know, hopefully that comes through at some point in time.
Yeah. I mean, I think it's, and again, we've talked to a lot of emerging managers on the pod in the past, and I think that challenge of raising capital as someone who is underrepresented in and of themselves, you know, it becomes harder because A, obviously there are fewer LPs that maybe can identify with them, but right. equally, you know, there comes a point where LPs like, yeah, I completely buy into your strategy. I just don't see the next guy, right? Like, so yes, I buy into you and I buy into your strategy and investing in kind of these underrep founders and underserved markets. But if you're investing at seed and the guy at Series A or Series B doesn't have that same philosophy and same thesis, I don't see where my upside is going to come from, right? Which becomes...
That shows up a lot. And when I tell... And people, you know, when people come out and say, well, you know, we saw this GP, she was raising for women, you know, and then, you know, she has 14 investments and only two are led by women. You know, what a disappointment. I'm like, well, you know, the way this system works, every GP is not raising just for the current fund. They're raising for the next one.
Yeah.
And the next one is going to be dependent on the way LPs look at the performance of the first one.
Yep.
And the LPs are like, well, which logos do you have, right? And who co-invested with you, right? And so what you then find is if you're not investing in companies that are going to be interesting immediately within 18 months to other investors that they know, that's problematic. And then there's also another interesting element, which was something I learned when I was at Intel, but I didn't sort of internalize until quite a bit recently, which is, you know, when I was chasing all those deals, right, I was competing against the very best firms in Silicon Valley, right, on Sand Hill Road, and I was winning, right? But what I didn't understand was that, and this is sort of a subtle point, you can't win too often. Because... here's the problem. LPs that want to invest in you as a fund manager, guess who they reference check against?
Yeah.
With their existing GPs. Right? Yeah. And so yesterday I'm going, okay.
I beat him down in these 20 deals. Yes. Like, what's he actually going to say about
What's he actually going to say about me? Because, you know, I went up against the best and I won.
Yeah.
Right? So that was also sort of an interesting thing, that there's a scratch my back, a scratch your back thing. But it really does prevent the true dislocators from, you know, getting traction.
Yeah.
Right? So yeah, it's fascinating.
It's crazy. Look, just as we start to wrap up, actually, you know, someone who's active in the African ecosystem, you know, one of the things that I find really challenging is that, you know, a lot of VCs that I've seen that operate in that market talk about, you know, yeah, we're investing, but we're looking for $1 million, $2 million EBITDA, Series B, Series C. So they're like almost kind of private equity investors rather than necessarily true venture. And what I think is the biggest challenge is getting pre-seed and seed funding at that very early stage, the riskiest stage, right? Because of the capital stack. So how do you think that can change and how can one change that fundraising dynamic for African startups?
So I sounded like a crazy person years ago when I said that the one thing that was important that I really loved about African entrepreneurs was that they learned how to be very resilient and capital efficient.
Yeah.
Right. Now, it may have, you know, created some sort of retardant on the size of the companies they could build in the long term, but they were also sort of much more resourceful. And then, you know, the frothies showed up, you know, and all of a sudden people were raising, you know, 10, 15, $20 million Series A's, and then, you know, and so on and so forth. And everybody got excited and thought they were, you know, truly great founders. And, you know, now we're at a place where it's risk off. And, you know, and a lot of these companies are just not, they're not performing.
Yeah.
Right, because everybody brought the copy and paste, you know, investing model into it, whereas that natural, you know, insight of, you know, founders in a prior generation where they were like, look, this investor dollar, I don't know if there's another one coming behind it, so I need to sort of make it, you know, you know, as Tupac used to say, I need to make a dollar out of 15 cents. That sort of mentality went away. And so, you know, I had this conversation yesterday and I was like, look, you know, founders just, you know, certainly in Africa have to think very differently about investing, right? Been saying this for a while, which is, you know, if you get into Y Combinator, that's great. I'm happy for you, right? You know, you can then get the Y Combinator tailwind to help you raise. It doesn't guarantee anything after that, but at least you'll be able to raise, you know, a little seven figures. But, you know, for pre-seed, you're just going to have to sit down and figure out how do I raise 200 grand, right? And what do I need to, what milestones do I need to get to with the 200 grand? I go raise another 500 to 700, right? And you're going to have to sort of, you know, again, you have to, as a founder and even as an emerging GP, your number one responsibility is to make a case for your existence. Why should you exist, right? And, you know, whether it's the market telling you or whatever it is, but that should be your number one, your responsibility, and you should think about it every day. And I think for a lot of these companies, you know, there's a lot of Me Too founders. I mean, not in the Me Too kind of sense, but like, well, if he can do it or she can do it, I can do it, me too, right?
Yeah.
But, you know, you don't see a lot of sort of real thought around, you know, why should this product exist, right?
And what is the burning need for this product in the market?
Right, and then, you know, who is going to adopt it? And what, you know, what how much do I actually need to do that? And so you find a lot of these founders in these markets, you know, who are, you know, who have what I call the OGA mentality, which is I want to be my own boss, so this is the fastest way to do it. But you haven't earned the right to be your own boss, right? And so, you know, is the pre-seed market still going? It is, right? But, you know, unfortunately, a lot of it is now around maybe founders who are coming out from other established companies, which actually should not be a bad thing. And hopefully you can find these types of investors. But a lot of them are still, they're still about what's hot, right? So, you know, they were like, well, logistics was 2020. You know, no one's doing that anymore. And you're thinking, well, the market hasn't improved.
Have you seen logistics in Nigeria
you
today?
You know, I mean, do you even know what it means to this, right? So it is really about finding these investors who I think is not just about good founders who can tell good narratives, but also about investors who can feel the pain.
And going back to like the earlier point, like, truly understand and empathize with the market.
Right. Like there is legitimate pain.
Yeah.
And this product is going to sort of either solve or mitigate or neutralize the pain. And I think there's also a narrative problem. Some of these founders are not very good at telling stories. But there is, Africa continues to be a giant digitization opportunity. But I think trying to bring the U.S. model of funding and so on and so forth, I think a lot of it has just encouraged and fomented bad behavior.
Sure.
Right. So a lot of sort of, you know, what I call low integrity and zero integrity behavior. And so I think part of that is, you know, our responsibility as investors is to clean that up.
Yeah.
Because, you know, I don't think we can go forward unless, you know, all that stuff gets resolved for us.
I mean, a huge amount to digest there, Egosa. I think we could have recorded another two podcasts, which we may well have to do if you're keen. But it's been amazing having you here with me today. For our audience, where's the best place for them to find you? You're on LinkedIn, you're on Twitter. Where's the best place for them to get in touch?
Well, our website is, you know, echovc.com, echovc.com. And I'm on Twitter. I'm a little bit active on Twitter.
Just a little,
you know, Egosa O, so EGHOSAO on Twitter. And then, of course, we're at Echo VC on Twitter as well. But, you know, we're very, very accessible. I mean, I think one excellent point is, you know, we've never been big believers in the whole construct of warm introductions.
Yeah, sure.
So some of our best performing portfolios came in through our website.
Amazing.
So, you know, we're very accessible.
Excellent. Egosa, it's been absolutely incredible having you here with me today. Thank you.
Thank you very much for having me.